Wellington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today. The first is a conversation I recorded late Friday afternoon with a former Carthage faculty colleague, Isabel Rivera Villa, about a documentary film of hers that was screened on the Carthage campus this past weekend. Today's broadcast is obviously occurring after the fact, but it's still an interview I think is worth hearing. In part two, we'll listen back to an archival interview with the great Indian chef and author Raghavan Iyer, one of the world's most renowned experts on curries. Mr. Iyer passed away on March 31st. Here's part one of today's morning show, an interview again recorded back on Friday. I am so honored in this portion of the morning show to be reconnecting with a former faculty colleague from Carthage College, Isabel Rivera Villa, who taught modern languages at Carthage for a number of years. How many years were you at Carthage?
20.
Oh, my gosh. Time flies when you're having fun. But she now teaches on the French faculty at American University in Washington, D.C. But in addition to all she does teaching, she is also a documentary filmmaker, and as a matter of fact, is an award-winning documentary filmmaker because of the extraordinarily enthusiastic response to what I believe is her most recent film, Afrikas and the Magic Box, which speaks to a lot of interests that she has, but in particular, the cinema of West Africa. And this film, as I understand it, is a celebration of the cinema in the nation of Senegal, and also explores some of the facets of culture there in Senegal, including the importance of mothers and mother figures in that particular culture. So before we talk about this film, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your connection to West Africa and what draws you to it, what has fueled your interest in this part of the world.
So thank you so much, Greg, for having me here. You really summarized well the film. My connection to West Africa started when I studied, when I was doing my PhD. It was about Francophone cinema. So that made me explore cinema in French-speaking countries. And when I discovered the cinema from Senegal, I was completely fascinated. And since then, I have been teaching French through cinema, and a lot of the films I used in my classes were Senegalese films, always, and or Senegalese literature, Senegalese music. I was very much fascinated by this culture that I had never been. So my first time going to Senegal was when I took my students from Carthage, around 25 students. We went in on a J-term to Senegal, and there I completely fell in love even more with the country and with the people. And since that study tour, I have been going twice a year and making connections and creating my family. My family of filmmakers that I have always admired, filmmakers whose films I use in my class, I was honored to meet them, and they are now in my film. So this was an homage to them, to their films, to their stories, and as you said, to their mother, the mother figure, because that's something that inspires filmmakers.
Do I remember Senegal is on the extreme western border? I mean, like that is on the Atlantic Ocean.
Yes.
And it is a relatively small country, but beyond that, I know next to nothing about it.
And the connection with cinema, the considered the father of African cinema is Ousmane Sembène, who was from Senegal. And he created a school. In fact, some of the characters in my film, who are filmmakers, actors, actresses, worked with him. Ah. So they had this legacy from one of the best filmmakers, Ousmane Sembène, or Djibril Diop Mambéty, another one as well. So top quality films are done in Senegal and in West Africa.
You said that you were really drawn to these films, and is it just because they are so well made, or did you utilize them in your classes because they were helpful? I mean, one could imagine a film that's not necessarily a great film but might nevertheless be useful in a classroom setting for what you were doing. But I think what you're saying is these were wonderfully made films. Can you tell us more about what made them so compelling to you? What is, in what way are they excellent?
Good question. They are artistic and they are very engaged with the current realities and of the country. So this is film that makes you think and makes you want to change the world. They are very inspiring, and that's what I want to discuss in my class. You know, these are some issues that happen in this country, and this is how the filmmaker is trying to make you think about it. Mm. Not just let's have fun and go and watch a film just to have fun. It's much more and more deep. And the way you, when you watch the film, it makes you think and try to interpret some images that are metaphoric or symbolic. Very artistic.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
So beyond just entertaining.
Much beyond. That's what drew me to this cinema.
Right.
Yes.
So tell us how this project came about, and is it something that you generated completely on your own, this decision to create a film about the films of Senegal? Was this your idea, or was it done at the invitation of someone else?
This was my idea. I created this course at Carthage, at West African Cinema, and then I taught it in collaboration with Peter Denis.
Ah.
So this class made me realize African cinema is not very well known. And let's how we can make this cinema better known. And I want to share with my students the amazing experience that I had in Senegal. I want to share with them these encounters that I had with these filmmakers. And so they understand other ways to see film and learn from it. Other ways of living, other perspectives. So, the idea came because I taught this class at Carthage, and I wanted to have this film to share with my students. Mm.
You had already been to Senegal by that point?
Yeah.
And how many times have you been to Senegal, actually?
6 times now.
Oh!
And I'm going again next month. I need it now. It's like a necessity.
Going back to the mothership or to the motherland almost.
Yeah, the people are so welcoming. I love the culture, the humanity, the closeness of the community. It's beautiful.
So describe what this film is like. Again, the title is Afrikas and the Magic Box. So first of all, explain what the magic box is in the title.
I don't want to explain it.
Oh.
I think it should be, I think you should see it to interpret why it's a magic box.
Okay.
So I would like to encourage the audience, if they are interested, to come to the screening tomorrow. They may see, because it has a lot of possible interpretations.
Sure. Tell us whatever you feel comfortable in terms of what people will see when they watch the film. I mean, how is it put together, and of what does it mostly consist?
So it's a 62-minute documentary film, and it's structured in 4 different episodes, and each episode has a different thematic: the mother figure, the women, freedom, and the Magic Box. So all of the interviews that I did, which was with seven different filmmakers, actors and actresses, what they say is intertwined in the different episodes with the different thematics, and they all coincide in many of the thematics. That's the beauty of documentary. I had my story written before filming, but then when you are when you are shooting, life happens, and it was in the middle of the pandemic too, so a lot of obstacles, and my story changed, but I think it was better. It was better because there were surprises that I didn't expect.
How long a period are we talking about in terms of from when you kind of conceived the film and first began seriously working on it versus the completed product? How long a time are we talking about?
Let's say start. Oh my God, 2019. I started thinking about it. Then 2020, I had written it. 2021, in the spring, I went to shoot. And 2022, in the spring, it was finished and complete. And then the whole festival tour. And now still in the festival tour. And now distribution. Now it just came in French TV, and it was shown in all the African countries and... Yeah, TV Cinq Mondes.
Wow. And we should mention, I don't think I've mentioned it yet, but I believe it won a very prestigious award at, among other things, the Cannes Independent Film Festival, which many of our listeners have heard of. And I believe it won the award for Best Feature Documentary. What a thrill.
Yes, I didn't expect this, but I'm very happy that people like the film, you know.
So many of your films do involve interviews that you conduct with various people to kind of bring us into their lives and for us to, in a sense, get to know them. Talk about that experience of sitting down with people in interview situations, and what do you think about in terms of trying to make the interviews as effective as possible?
So before having the interviews, you have to have develop a close relationship with the people you are interviewing. So that I couldn't spend as much time as I wanted because limited availability because of the times that this happened. But still, I was able to build a relationship enough that they would trust me, they would trust my project, and they would open their house or wherever they were, they would open up. And that was the most beautiful of all. The whole film experienced this relation that I had with the characters, with my subjects, with the people that participated. How these interviews changed me, because these are filmmakers that are telling me what inspires them, how they do film. And I was doing my first feature, and I was looking for advice from the people I admire. So they help shape my film, and not only with the interviews, but also me afterwards editing it, etc. So it was wonderful.
Amazing. Is this work on these documentary films, is this at all a part of your official duties at American University where you teach French? Or is this something completely apart from those duties and responsibilities?
It is completely apart. It's like I have two professions, filmmaker and professor. But I use my film in my classes.
Right.
So that is always, encouraged. I'm encouraged to keep working, but it's not part of my obligations. No. I do this because I have a passion for film and for Africa. And it works. It works. My students like the films, and we have very interesting conversations. And I invite filmmakers to class. I organize film festivals. I collaborate with the embassies because, the embassy is right there. I'm in charge of selecting all of the African films for the different festivals that the embassy organizes.
Wow.
I organize the roundtables. I am the moderator with all of the filmmakers that come. So I'm And I do all of this on the side because I love it.
Mm.
And that makes me happy.
We are recording this interview on late Friday afternoon, and Saturday evening, your film, Africas and the Magic Box, will be screened at Carthage. And this is a free public screening in the Campbell Student Union Auditorium at 7 o'clock Saturday evening, with an opportunity afterwards for you to answer any questions that people in the audience might have.
Yes, and that's always rewarding. I always love this Q&A discussions with the public because, you know, it's very interesting to have exchange, to have the opinions of the audience and their perspectives, and I'm interested in that exchange.
Very good.
So I welcome everyone to come.
And that screening again, Saturday evening at 7 o'clock. Now, some people hearing our conversation, that will have already passed. But you were saying that this film is beginning to become available through various platforms. Are any of those platforms available to us here in the United States at this point?
So they are all available in the United States. One platform, TV 5 Monde, has the film only in French, so that wouldn't work. But I have Alexander Street, so this is a library for universities that has the film.
Hmm.
Then Rootflix, which is the version of Netflix, but with only African films, that has it too, Rootflix. And then Breaking TV, which is an app, English from London, that also have my film. So some apps, and then Alexander Street and TV 5 Monde.
Very good. And I have a feeling, thanks to all of these awards, the many awards which it has received, that this film will receive wider and wider circulation. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Isabel Rivera-Villa, who once was a member of the faculty at Carthage College for many, many years. In fact, she was saying before we went on the air about how one of her happiest experiences while at Carthage was accompanying the Carthage Choir and then conductor Eduardo Garcia Novelli on the choir's tour of Spain. And I know the students dearly appreciated the help that you were to them. Now she is a professor of French at American University in Washington, D.C. I do want to ask you what precipitated your love of cinema and also inspired you to take that first step to do some filmmaking of your own, because it seems to me that's a huge leap. I mean, one can love cinema, but not necessarily either be tempted to make film yourself or ever take that plunge to actually do that. Can you tell us what it was that drew you to want to do this kind of work?
So I always, when I teach languages, I always use film. And sometimes I wouldn't find the film that would show what I wanted to show. Mm. And that frustrated me. And I thought, I would like to do my own. I would like to go there and film what I really have experienced that I would like my students to see and experience as well. So that decided me, okay, I'm going to take evening classes at Carthage. So during the daytime, I taught. During the evening, I took cinema classes for 4 years. Then during the weekends, I went to Chicago to take more classes. And then during my filming in Senegal, I was doing my master in documentary filmmaking at the same time in the morning.
Oh, boy.
It was crazy. But that helped me, you know, all of these classes help you really understand film and be creative and artistic. And you analyze so many films and the different ways you can interpret some symbols, and it's fun to play with that. But you need to study.
Mm.
So I did that because I wanted to show things that I couldn't find, you know, in the films that I was using in my classes.
Right, and it sounds like even beyond the borders of Senegal, it is Western Africa that interests you, and the cinema of other nations even besides Senegal, is
yes,
that right?
Yes. Well, right now I'm very, very focused on Africa and West Africa. Yeah, other countries too, Ivory Coast, Mali. Mm. I use a lot of film of Mali, Morocco, Algeria, Mauritania. But I'm North and West Africa is my main interest so far. Mm. But I love film from everywhere.
Well, then it's, of course, it's a big world, and the world of cinema is a big world. And there are all kinds of things that one can enjoy.
Yeah, we learn so much from other cultures. We learn so much from other people. And I think cinema brings us together.
Mm. Tell us about teaching at American University, and what is that like to be at a school very, very different from Carthage, of course?
Yes, it is different. I teach my language or topics courses, and my students are basically studying diplomatic relations, School of International Service. So they are going to become future diplomats. So they are required to take language class. Mm. And I like that. They are very interested in, you know, in broader their horizons in Africa. They are very interested in Africa. So that is I like. And I am more free to film. I have more time because I'm not tenured like I used to be in Carthage. So even though I still organize festivals, but I have still more time to concentrate on my new passion career. Hopefully one day I will only do that.
Ah.
Filmmaking, that would be my dream.
Wow. So in
10 years or so, hopefully.
Right. So in many respects, this is your first love or highest love.
Yes, wow. It is. That's my hope.
Do you feel when you are making films that you are, in a sense, still teaching? Does it feel like a different kind of teaching, or does it feel like a completely different pursuit than teaching in a classroom?
You have really good questions. Yeah, I think so, because the topics I choose, why do I choose them? I don't want to use my film to teach, but there is a message. And hopefully that message helps change some things, you know. And we do that in our teaching as well.
Right.
And when we discuss the film, that part is also similar. So, yeah, I think it's a good combination.
And it sounds like film has been a useful tool for you for just about as long as you've been teaching.
Yeah.
Is it a common tool? I mean, is it a commonly used tool, or is it relatively rare for someone teaching the course, kind of courses you teach, to utilize film in the way that you use it?
It is commonly used, film, but maybe not as much. Like in every class I have, there is a sequence. There is a sequence that will teach something. Either a structure, either vocabulary, cultural context, something. Always, because I believe in the power of visual, of images, and we live in a society, the generations live with this. We are in this world of images.
Yeah.
So my classes cannot, there is not a single class where I haven't used a sequence of a film or a documentary or something.
Yeah. Well, the results speak for themselves, and of course it is so exciting to see this wonderful success which you are enjoying now with this most recent film, Afrikas and the Magic Box. Are you at work on your next film?
Yes. So I started already filming in March. It's about music.
Ah.
But I'm not going to share much because I'm still starting The first portion is film. I film it in Luxembourg.
Oh.
And the next portion will be film in Paris. Different musicians, different paths of life, many surprises.
Ah, fascinating. Ah, well, we await that with great, great interest. And once again, we want to remind for people hearing this interview in time about the free screening of her most recent film, Afrikas and the Magic Box, Saturday evening at 7 p.m. and in the Campbell Student Union Auditorium with a question and answer period afterwards, where you can ask any questions you like of the filmmaker Isabel Rivera Vila. And for those of you hearing this interview too late to take advantage of that public screening, the film is available now on a number of different platforms, and I suspect by just Googling the title, a lot of those can be pulled up and accessed. And if you visit Isabel Rivera's Vila's website, you will see this long list of the awards that have been given to this film, Africasa and the Magic Box. So it is wonderful to see you enjoying such great success, and we hope that indeed many, many more films will be coming from you for all of us to enjoy. Isabel Rivera Vila, wonderful to reconnect with you. Best wishes to you and in all your future endeavors, and thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Greg. Thank you.
The preceding morning show interview was recorded late Friday afternoon. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're listening back to an archival interview that I recorded some years ago with Raghavan Iyer, Indian-born chef and author and a world-renowned expert on curries. Raghavan Iyer was born in 1961 in India, raised in Mumbai, but moved to the United States in the early 1980s to study hospitality at a couple of different Midwestern universities. Mr. Iyer eventually became a chef and then a cookbook author. His first book, published more than 20 years ago, was Betty Crocker's Indian Home Cooking, which introduced many Americans to the beauty of Indian cuisine. I was scheduled to interview Mr. Iyer on the 1st of March about his most recent book, On the Curry Trail, Chasing the Flavor That Seduced the World, a lovely book that traces the diaspora of curries from out of India and Pakistan to Africa, Europe, and the Americas, giving the reader an idea of the astonishing variation of curry cuisine found all over the world. Sadly, Mr. Iyer was forced to cancel our interview because of illness, and 30 days later, he was gone. I'm very thankful that I had the opportunity to interview Mr. Iyer back in 2008 about one of his previous books, and I want to share that interview now from the Morning Show archives in his memory. Well, we are going to have a delicious few minutes now speaking with an award-winning chef and a chef and cooking teacher by the name of Raghavan Iyer. And Raghavan Iyer is responsible for a wonderful new book called 660 Curries, The Gateway to Indian Cooking. And in this book, we learn exactly what the term curry means. And it means actually different things in different places. But of course, it means more than anything, a rich, wonderful array of dishes that come to the world from the colorful nation of India. And Raghavan Iyer comes at this task with a lot of expertise and has won awards as a cooking teacher. He's also the author of the Betty Crocker Indian Home Cooking book. And this latest book is really a beautiful work of art with all kinds of recipes and all kinds of fascinating information about curries. 660 Curries is published by Workman Publishing. And Raghavan Iyer, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Greg.
You know, it's interesting. It's not the book we're specifically talking about today, but I keep finding my eyes drawn back to the title, Betty Crocker's Indian Home Cooking. I mean, in a sense, that really shows us something about how much the world has changed, the culinary world. That, I mean, 50 years ago, the thought of a Betty Crocker book concerning itself with Indian cuisine would be just unthinkable. And now it obviously exists, and we are just part of this global village in which we are starting to really understand and appreciate and enjoy one another's foods.
Perfect time to really appreciate the diversity and the variety that you find in the world of Indian curries. And I think, you know, people always ask me, you know, 660 curries, is there more? And I said, yes, there is, and I got tired after 660. But I think, you know, when you think about the world of Indian curry, I always say it's interesting because curry itself is a word that is not spoken in any of the 23 languages in India. We have words that sound similar to curry, and they all are words that signify dishes that have a sauce or a gravy to it. So when it comes to Indian curries, I always say associate the four S's with it. They're saucy, they're spicy, they're simple, and they're sensational. Mm-hmm. Sort of like me.
I think one thing that's interesting is the image you use of being a chemist. Uh-huh. And that comes up quite a lot in the pages of this book in describing the way you cook and even the process of trying to get a tight handle on the term curry itself. I mean, mm-hmm. in a sense for you, this has been a bit of a scientific undertaking as well.
It has been. And I think, you know, as a cooking teacher of 18 years, I always said the best tool I can give my students is to empower them with what curries are all about. And I wanted to teach them and give them the tools that let it happen. And it's all about building that saucy repertoire. And, you know, to give you an example, you know, when you think about we are entering really grilling season here shortly, and I always say a perfect thing to do is to, if you take, if you love lamb, you could take lamb chops from the rib rack, and you can slice it, and oftentimes I would say you could take a little bit of a ginger and garlic and rub it over the lamb and then grill it on an outdoor grill. It's not a curry at this point in time, but you bring, you take a little skillet and then drizzle a little bit of oil and throw in some cumin seeds in that hot oil, which will sizzle in about 5 or 10 seconds. Throw in a little bit of red onions and add some tomatoes to that with some fresh herbs like cilantro and chilies, a touch of salt, and then all of a sudden you've got the sauce component that you're going to drape over the grilled lamb chops, and you have an incredibly savory, delicious layered dish within 30 minutes, start to finish.
Let me reread the definition, which I think you gave sort of a condensed version of at the top of the interview. You define a curry as any dish that consists of meat, fish, poultry, legumes, vegetable, or fruits simmered in or covered with a sauce, gravy, or other liquid that is redolent of spices and or herbs. I guess that last part is especially crucial because if you leave that out, then something like Hamburger Helper almost qualifies as a curry. But, of course, you know, Hamburger Helper or anything like it that comes out of a box does not give us that wonderful array of spices and herbs that you say are really central to the cuisine of curries.
Absolutely. And I've always said, you know, herbs and spices are the backbone to Indian curries, even though there are many curries in India that don't have any spices in it, but just fresh herbs, for instance. There's a wonderful eggplant dish that comes to mind. The vegetable curry chapter alone has over 200 recipes in it. And I have a really nice eggplant that I grill or broil, char the skin out, and then you could take the pulp and mash it. And then I have actually stir-fried that with a little bit of oil or clarified butter and throw in three ingredients to flavor it, fresh garlic, red chilies, and salt. And that's it. And it's an incredibly layered dish. And oftentimes I will take that and lather that onto pieces of crusty crostinis, and then you could do a great appetizer out of it and serve that with what Indians do. You serve it with scotch. But it is a wonderful way to explore the world of curry.
By the way, help us understand, I guess, a misconception. That is, a lot of people assume that if you're talking about a dish with the name curry, then it's obviously something in which you've poured a bunch of curry powder in.
Yes.
And in fact, that isn't really directly the case at all. What does curry powder have to do with this whole cuisine? Is it just one of many possible elements?
No, actually, curry powder is I've always said no self-respecting Indian home kitchen has curry powders in it. Curry powders are non-existent in Indian home kitchens. the concept of a curry powder originated with the English being in India in the early 16th century, and they loved the flavors of some of the sauces they've tried, and they captured that into a bottle called curry powders, and they have done an amazing job of marketing that to the rest of the world. I've always said curry is never added, it just is. I think all of a sudden when you think about it in that context, you realize that there's such a depth to the layers of curries in Indian kitchens.
So curry powder, in a sense, is a shortcut and not a very good shortcut at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a sense, it is the antithesis of what your book is all about, which is
yes.
this almost limitless array of spices and herbs that make all of this so wonderful.
Absolutely, and I think you've hit the nail on the head with that. When you use curry powders, you sort of pigeonhole your flavors, and you really don't have that remarkable array of flavors you get. I talk about, in the spice chapter, I talk about how we can extract 8 flavors from a given spice, and these are all distinct flavors that are poles apart. And then you take that concept and multiply that by the hundreds of spices we use. You've sort of taken a peek into the world of Indian curry. So it is it's a groundbreaking concept, and I think a lot of people don't realize the depth of Indian curry. 660 curries is a lot, and I've always said there's actually, you know, I wanted to do 1,001 curries. And when you think about it in that context, I think it opens up a whole new world.
Sure. We're talking with Raghavan Iyer about his book, 660 Curries, The Gateway to Indian Cooking. Just let's go with spices for a moment, because mm-hmm. this is an especially interesting chapter in the book. You devote a whole chapter to spices, spice blends and pastes. One of your most basic bits of advice, and we've probably received this advice from others, but you're very persuasive in saying how important it is that we buy our spices in their whole forms. Explain, first of all, what you mean by that and why that is so crucially important.
Sure. I think, you know, when I talk about buying spices in the whole seed form, to give an example, even if you take cumin seeds, you know, which everybody is so familiar with, when you buy spices, like, first of all, whole spices will keep for quite a while, I would say at least even a couple of years, outside the refrigerator in an airtight container. Because I talk about buying whole spices, as I alluded to earlier, we can extract 8 flavors from a given spice. To run through very quickly, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what some of those flavors are. When you use a spice as is in the whole seed form, you get one flavor. When they're ground raw, you get a second flavor. When they're dry toasted, left in the seed form, you get a third flavor. When they're ground after it has been dry toasted, you get a fourth flavor. When they're sauteed in some kind of a fat, left in the seed form, you get flavor number 5. When they're ground after they've been sauteed, you get flavor number 6. When they're soaked in some kind of a liquid used in the seed form, you get flavor number 7. And then when they're ground after they've been soaked in a liquid, you get flavor number 8. And then keep in mind that the kind of liquid you use will change the flavor of the spice. And so they just get deeper and deeper. And that's one of the reasons why I think buying whole spices and teasing all these different flavors out of it makes it so fascinating.
And this chapter of the book not only then gives advice on how to store whole spices and various ways to grind them, but then you have what really appear to be recipes for spices, for spice blends, for putting different spices together in absolutely wonderful ways.
And I think, you know, oftentimes when you start to cook from the book and you'll make all these curries, you will find yourself coming back to the spice blend and paste chapter to put together some of the blends. And keep in mind, these blends, each and every blend I would say 99% of them will take you 5 minutes or less to put together. And some of these dry blends will keep for 2 to 3 months outside the refrigerator. So all of a sudden, when you do it one time, 5 minutes or less, you will have it on hand every time you want to do something very quickly. And I also talk about in that chapter, I give you sort of the top five or top seven blends and pastes you can put together that will cover, let's say, 60 to 70% of the book. So it is a very efficient way of doing it. And also, it perks up your everyday fare within minutes. I also have a chapter on what I call curry cohorts that are designed to complement the flavors of curries, everything from rice dishes to flatbread to condiments and pickles and yogurt accompaniments that enhance the eating experience of curry. So it is a complete way to, I've always said 660 curries is one curry a day for 2 years with time off for holidays.
Very good. One thing that's intriguing in the body of the book, where you have all kinds of different recipes, many of them your own, but some from others, is that almost without exception, I think, when a recipe is from someone in your life, you tell us a little bit about them. You tell us their name and often what they do for a living. And I don't remember ever seeing that before in a cookbook. And I think it's such a wonderful choice you've made.
Well, thank you. And I think, you know, oftentimes you alluded to the fact that we live in a global market now. And I think food is the medium that connects cultures and people. And when you start to personalize a dish that could be exotic sounding and very foreign, but then you personalize it and then attach a name and a character and a little story to go with it, I think that becomes very universal all of a sudden, and it is no longer foreign and strange. And I always wanted to bridge cultures and bridge gaps, and I think talking a little bit about where the recipe comes from, who provided it, a little bit about their life, I think makes it much more in your backyard sort of a concept. And that's really one of the things I wanted to do in this book. I'm glad you saw that and you appreciated it. And I hope that a lot of your listeners would feel the same way.
I was intrigued to find mention, particularly in the poultry chapter, but I'm sure in other sections as well, mention of the Indian wok, W-O-K. Is that significantly different from the wok that we know from other cultures and cuisines?
Yes. We actually, our Indian woks are called kadhai. And you keep in mind that our kadhais have been in existence for, I would say, over 5,000 years, because India is a country that is at least 6,000 years old. Our woks are very, they're very similar to actually some of the Japanese-style woks. They have a much more of a rounded bottom, our woks in India don't have handles, and we have pliers. They look like pliers or tongs, and we hold on to our woks, and we do our stir-frying and our simmering and so on. And they can range, most of the woks tend to be actually of cast iron. There are some woks that are done with clay. There are some woks that are done with anodized metals. And so the transfer and the retaining of heat is really quite optimal. So they do range, and you get some phenomenally delicious flavors out of them. We use our woks not only for stir-frying, but in fact many of our curries that often require simmering and stewing. The woks work really well, especially when they're well seasoned. I do end up using. I do have quite a wonderful array of woks, some of which I brought back from India on numerous trips that I do food and cultural tours to India. And so when I come back with some different kinds of utensils and woks, and I just I love how the curries do have such interesting flavors and techniques that you can create
right.
in those vessels.
There's a whole chapter devoted to legume curries, another
uh-huh.
to beef and pork and lamb, another to seafood, another to poultry, another to vegetable curries. You say the Indian people are particularly masterful when it comes to evoking wonderful flavors from the world of vegetables. So
yeah.
there's going to be something for just about everybody in the pages of this book. I'm just curious, for those of us who really only know Indian cuisine from having maybe visited an Indian restaurant, I'm prompted to ask this question because I recently interviewed the author of a book about Chinese restaurants who emphatically made the point that your typical Chinese restaurant is serving food that is really not Chinese at all, at least in terms of the kind of food that people in China eat. What about Indian restaurants here in the United States? When we go to one, are we at all experiencing what the good people of India eat?
More often than not, I think you are not experiencing the gamut of flavors and textures. Most of the Indian restaurants in the Western world feature a very small part of Northwestern Indian cooking, the cooking of Punjab and the cooking of the Mughal court. The Mughals had a very strong influence in Indian cooking and culture and architecture in northern India, and they were the rulers just prior to the British taking over. And so you see a small slice of that represented in Indian restaurants and dishes like tandoori chicken or naan or some of the four limited curries that you find in these restaurants. And so the flavors are much more limited, and it doesn't show the extent and the full-bodied nature of some of the saucy repertoires you find back in India. And so very reluctantly, I say, they show a very small slice of that region. And, if you've never had Indian food, I'd say a great place to start would be at an Indian restaurant, just so you get accustomed to something. But keep in mind, as a cooking teacher of 18 years, I've had students that keep coming back to me and said, you have spoiled Indian restaurants for us, because the foods are, when I cook Indian food at home, it just takes it from level 1 to level 99 in a matter of minutes. And I think that, to me, shows really the beauty and the depth of working with some of the herbs and spices that form our spicy repertoire.
The book, again, is called 660 Curries, The Gateway to Indian Cooking. All kinds of wonderful information and illustrations, a plethora of terrific, fascinating recipes, and all kinds of little sidelight facts about cuisine in India, how someone in India sits down and eats a meal, backup information about some of these interesting foods. It's an absolutely fascinating book, and it's published by Workman, and it's author Raghavan Iyer. Raghavan Iyer, I enjoyed this book so much. I look forward to the challenge of using it, and I so enjoyed talking with you about it. Best wishes to you.
Well, thank you so much, Greg, for letting me come into your studios and into all your listeners' homes, and I really wish that people would get into it and adopt the whole concept of Indian curry on a daily basis.
Raghavan Iyer, we thank you again.
Thanks again, Greg.
The preceding interview with Raghavan Iyer was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2008. Mr. Iyer passed away on March 31st at the age of 61. He died of cancer. His most recent book is titled On the Curry Trail, Chasing the Flavor That Seduced the World in 50 Recipes. The book is published by Workman Publishing. I highly recommend it. I'm Gregory Berg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll have an entirely musical program, and it will begin with Alvaro Garcia, who is the director of orchestral activities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. With him will be Nina Frongian, who is the current Howard Brown Artist in Residence, a fine violinist who this coming weekend is going to be performing the violin concerto of Alexander Glazunov with the Parkside Orchestras. In part two, we'll hear about the next